This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Rob Heaton for New Books in Biblical Studies, where I focus on new and exciting scholarship in New Testament and Early Christian Studies, which is the orbit of my own PhD. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Richard Ascoff about the publication of his collected essays relating to the breadth of data that we have on Greco-Roman voluntary associations and the relevance of that data to the study of early Christ-following groups, such as Paul's church communities. We'll dive into all that in short order. But first, let me introduce my guest. Richard S. Ascoff received his PhD in 1997 from the Toronto School of Theology and is a professor at the School of Religion at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. He has written extensively on the formation of early Christ groups and Greco-Roman religious culture, with particular attention to various types of associations. He has published widely in the field with more than 50 articles or essays and 13 books, some of which include Christ Groups and Associations, Foundational Essays, published just a couple of years ago, or just last year rather, Associations in the Greco-Roman World, a source book, which was published with Philip Harland and John Kloppenberg, and is short to receive a new edition, I believe, and Paul's Macedonian Associations with Moore Zipek in 2003, and I think that has also recently had a new edition. He's been recognized for his innovative and effective teaching in many ways, including the top two teaching awards at Queen's University and a 3M National Teaching Fellowship 5 years ago. On top of all this, Richard is joining us today from his home base in Ontario to discuss the publication of Early Christ Groups and Greco-Roman Associations with a subtitle Organizational Models and Social Practices. And it was published with Cascade Books, which is an imprint of Whip and Stock Publishers. All that aside, Richard, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the New Books Network.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful to have you. So let's hop right into your book, I suppose, and we'll learn more about you in the process as well. In your introduction, this book, you say, is a collection of your essays published in various journals and edited volumes over the course of the last 25 years or so. So it's kind of a hallmark of your scholarship. But it also serves as a retrospective highlighting this work that you've done over this last quarter century. Contributions to the field in a way that a traditional monograph, which is kind of one particular point in time, might not indicate. How did this book come to fruition, and what was it like revisiting these older essays for this volume?
Yeah, it was interesting. I've had some encouragement to do this for a few years before it was published. People saying, you know, sometimes it's nice to see sort of the arc of an arguments that have been made by an individual scholar. I had a sabbatical, and there was another book project I really wanted to work on as well, a collection of essays of about voluntary associations and Christ groups by other authors. And I decided it might make sense to do that book, which covers 150 years and has one or two of my essays in it. And then this book, which is kind of my contribution over the last few decades. And I worked on both of those projects during my sabbatical. So I was just immersed in that. It's funny. It feels a bit like a greatest hits album for a rock band. I'm gonna like, you know, you have some great hits, and that others are a bit of filler. And I it was interesting going back to some of them and thinking, I don't know if I'd write it that way again. Sure. But it's there, mm-hmm. and now it's a little bit more easily accessible. You know, some of these things are in books that might not be in libraries or aren't yet converted to PDF. Some of them are journals that haven't yet been published. So that was kind of a bit on the selection, but I also wanted to hang together kinds of how do we model what kind of recruitment practices were there, and then meals and death. So there's other stuff I did on associations that aren't in there, or even on those topics that I couldn't fit in. So these ones I thought really made a contribution and people are reacting to. So now students and other scholars could take a look at them, see what they think.
I imagine it would take a pretty long time for someone to collect the essays on their own, but they're organized in a way that feels pretty natural to me. And we'll get into the organization of the book in a little bit. But as you mentioned at the outset of the book, I think it's worth spending some time on here. It's interesting how you got started in this work on voluntary associations. You know, you say that you were part of a small group of people who were translating the tedious and often unrewarding data from inscriptions, epigraphy, non-literary papyri, and so on. So how did you get started with this early assignment? Because it sounds like it was assigned to you. I don't know if that's true exactly, but how did this focus on the ways that people in antiquity would organize and self-represent and so on? How did that lead to a niche for you?
So it's a great question, and I can start by saying I had no idea it would turn into my career.
Okay.
So I have to go all the way back to 1992, and I'm finishing my master's degree in Toronto, and I'm starting to work on my PhD. And I knew John Kloppenborg a little bit. I'd been working with him and taking some courses, and he invited me to be part of a translation group that was simply, we'll eat dinner together, and we'll translate some previously untranslated Greek to practice our Greek. Mm. So it was him, another professor, a postdoc, and me, a lowly MA student. It was absolutely terrifying.
I bet.
And so the postdoc is the one that said, Bradley McLean, he went on to write a whole textbook on Greek epigraphy. He said, you know, these inscriptions haven't been translated. Parallel to this, the Canadian Society of Biblical Studies was doing a 3-year seminar on the associations, kind of revisiting the work of Wayne Meeks. So it made sense to do these. But the real thing was practice our Greek. I was going to write my PhD dissertation on Luke Acts. But the more we got into the association inscriptions, the more fascinated we all got with them in our own different ways. And one of the things that I found that I tended to do when we'd work on an inscription, I'd say, that kind of sounds like Paul. And I started running with it with a couple of, you know, the Translocal Links paper was a course paper for a PhD course with John Kloppenborg. So I started running with these ideas, and it just sucked me in. But yeah, it was the whole dinner every 2 weeks with your professors and then be put on the spot about Greek inscriptions. That was tough.
How much of that was dinner and how much of it was translation? And I guess I'll bundle this in with another question that I had. Did you always, it sounds like you were intending to work on Christian material. Did this feel like a parabolic way around to it? Like it's an interesting way to come at the Christian material as we think of it.
Yeah, the intent was for me was the Christian material, and so this was kind of a side piece. But I really was focused on the social world. This was the heyday of the social context group that Bruce Molina had started, mm-hmm. and others. So a lot of emphasis on anthropological and sociological kinds of studies, and so these inscriptions gave us data to kind of fill in some gaps that literary texts didn't. And so this really was why I thought, well, even for working on the Gospels, this will be helpful. In terms of the meal verses, fortunately, very quickly on, some other graduate students were invited to join. So Bill Arnell did a bit, Alicia Batten, and then eventually Phil Harlan was part of the group, and some others. And so then it felt a little bit more natural, and we could commiserate together as students and check things. But what was really good is nobody was an expert on epigraphy. And so we learned as we went. And Brandon McLean is the one that ran with it the most and kind of got in touch with epigraphers and brought back some stuff and, you know, chapters of what eventually became his handbook to Greek epigraphy, which is, you know, now well recognized in the field of epigraphy. So you know, there's always when you're a student, you know, how long can we extend dinner? And you know, maybe we'll get to my turn to translate a few sentences. But at the same time, it was really good to do that. And then, you know, if you read, I don't know why you would, but if you read the association source book from front to back, you realize there's a lot of repetition of phrasing. And so then we'd start to see patterns of formulas that they would use. Once you learn about sort of Macedonian dating or other ways of dating, then you recognize it in the text. Oh, this is, you know, this is such as this is, you know, the middle of the second century CE kind of thing. So it became easier as we went.
I didn't read it front to back, but I did acquire it, and I did look into it, and I did take interesting things. Like I, you know, flag certain pages, like, wow, that's interesting. That might be useful in the future.
It's exactly what we wanted to do.
Exactly.
To say, hey, I can do something with that.
Absolutely. Now onto your scholarship away from the source book. I'm not sure it's possible or even desirable at all to take from this book of yours from Cascade, this early Christ groups and Greco-Roman associations. I don't know if it's possible to sift out a single thesis from this all, but based on my reading of these different essays, you've published widely on the relevance of Greco-Roman associations to the study of early Christ groups. Parts of this involve supporting this category of associations as a comparable set of data. So there are scholars in the field at the time that were not interested in looking at what these associations were doing and if this was relevant, whereas you all sitting around the table, like you thought this is very relevant. But there are other models that scholars had relied on in the past, such as the synagogue or the mystery religion or the philosophical school that they thought were more comparable to early Christ groups. So that constitutes part one of your book. I forget exactly how you phrase it there, but showing the relevance of associations to early Christianity. And then from there in parts two and three of the book, you have sort of an encyclopedic knowledge of this association data, and then you kind of show it off, how it's relevant to early Christ groups. But let's stick for the moment in part one of your book. And I'll just ask some basic questions for the audience. What, broadly speaking, are voluntary associations in the ancient world? What different forms could they take, and what traits or qualities did they have in common? And you could talk about the journey of this. How have they become almost universally acknowledged now as relevant comparanda for the study of early Christianity?
Yeah, I'll start with the last part of that and work a little bit backwards, because it is a bit odd now for me. I mean, satisfying, but also worrying how people jump in now. And even, you know, some recent material I've heard at conferences or read where people say, well, why are we even talking about the relevance of associations? Of course they are. And so it makes my mind jumps back to when I was writing some of those early essays, when it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And how much resistance we had to using this model, and the sort of repetition of the pushback in the same way. So then to you know, what are voluntary associations, and why do we see them as important? I think the data was very limited. People knew a bit more about synagogues, a bit more about philosophical schools than about the association. So there wasn't a lot of data there. And in Wayne Meek's book, he comes up with this fourfold taxonomy for early Christ groups: the household, philosophical school, synagogue, associations. And he says, you know, a synagogue makes the most sense. And you know, that makes, if you read Acts, certainly that's what it looks like Paul was doing. And it seemed to us when we read Paul, he says very clearly, you know, other people are going to the Judeans, but I'm not. And that's a bit different than that action. It's not that the synagogues weren't relevant. We just thought maybe we could test out another way of thinking about associative behavior. So let me then back up when we were starting. It's like, at first, it was a lot on voluntary associations. And this was the term that was being used from all through the 20th century and even earlier to distinguish them from things like the official or semi-official cults like the Augustales or the Naoi or some groups that were sort of more clearly sponsored by the state. It took us about a decade to drop the term voluntary. Okay. I tried elective social formations for a while. That's in one of the chapters in this book. It was for the Fesher for Jonathan Z. Smith. He liked the term, but nobody else did. So no one knew it. And elective is a lot better than voluntary because, and the reason it's important is for example, an occupational association, if you're a carpenter working in Philippi, you might volunteer to join this group, but it might not really be volunteer. If you don't join, you don't really get a lot of work.
Sure.
You're not in the social network where you would find out about work, that you'd be able to join a crew or something like that. We questioned what that meant. So now we just talk about associations.
Okay.
So that was one big piece, but still keeping in mind they have an odd relationship to the state, particularly in the Roman world, where technically they're banned, but they're tolerated and in fact sometimes encouraged, and they're quite public. So they're not really illegal. And then as we sort of figured out what these groups were and what they looked like and how they might help us understand Christ groups, at least in my mind, I imagine not overlapping Venn diagrams, but this sort of larger circle in which we put in things like an Isis, Isis groups, Dionysus groups, Mithras groups, Christ groups, synagogues, philosophical associations. It seemed to me that it's a broader, more encompassing term about associative behavior. And then the comparison is within that. So compare a Christ group to a Dionysus group with respect to how they eat meals or how they structure leadership. And you can do that with synagogues. You can do that with Mithras groups. And so then to the third part of your question, why it matters, and if there's a single thesis that kind of ran through the book, but especially this first part, I think it's saying, well, it sounds odd to say, but Christ groups weren't special. That the old paradigm, and we still see it a lot, of Jews, Christians, and others, as if others is a separate category where everybody would be self-identified as a thing the same way Judeans could be or Christians could be. That doesn't make sense. All we have is others. Mm-hmm. We put Judeans in there, Christ groups in there, and sometimes the synagogue is the best comparator for an early Christ group, and vice versa. We can learn about synagogues by looking at how these early people that are following a Jewish Messiah, how they structure things. What does that help us learn about Judaism at that time? Because it's not separate. It's not a separate category. It's within this more amorphous thing of group behavior. So the edges become fuzzier. And I could stop there, but I could say more about that. That's, I think, really what I was going for early on. And not that associations are different than or better than synagogues or philosophical schools, but are part of a larger conversation that involves all of them.
Right. And this is how people chose to associate with one another. And even though you have dropped the language of voluntary or elective didn't catch on quite as much, but mostly people choose the social groups that they're in, and they have similar ways as the world around them of organizing and partaking in meals and promoting themselves and so on and so forth. And I think you established that well in part one of the book. To pick on something that you mentioned, though, these groups are officially banned. Can you say a little bit more about that and why, and why the ruling authorities were so afraid of people gathering?
I think they're primarily nervous about them becoming political, and certainly self-evident, Cicero, others, of these groups getting involved in political campaigns and the unruly behavior that would encourage. So one example, some of these groups met in taverns, which of course is never a good place for or isn't exactly where you want to have political discussions. But with enough wine, people can wax eloquent, and it can turn into more unruly things. So we find times when the magistrates say, we have to stop this unruly behavior of these groups, so shut down the taverns, right? So that's clearly where they're meeting, and this will do. But they also had, traders or groups of working on the docks had a social life with one another. They ate meals together. They took care of burying one another, particularly when they didn't have family around. They had ways of connecting that also reined in some of that discontentedness. So on the one hand, they're encouraged because of that. On the other hand, the legislation has been there since the Republican period, banning them. Julius Caesar, Augustus, sort of open it up a little bit. Here's some that can be allowed. And you get to the letters of Pliny and Bithynia writing to the Emperor Trajan, who says, I don't know what to do with these Christians, but I know groups are banned. And Trajan's like, just got to leave them alone. But then when he asks about firefighters in another city, Trajan's like, hard no. Don't let that group of association form. So he's clearly worried. The analogy that I use with my students is it's like driving on a highway. The speed limit might be 60 miles an hour, but if the flow of traffic is 70 miles an hour, when you go by a police car at 70, you're probably fine. They're not going to. But if you're going at 100, they're going to pull you over. But even at 70, if they feel like it, they might pull you over. Right, because the law is there. You're breaking the law, but for the most part, it's like, just let the cars go. Everything's fine.
Sure. Let's see here. Let's talk a little bit more about the biases that were existing in scholarship when you started this work, and especially how your work played off of that of Wayne Meeks. So we've mentioned him a couple of times already in our discussion, but we're talking about his book, The First Urban Christians, I believe.
Yeah.
In chapter 4 of this book, you talk about how major studies that preceded yours, such as his, embraced the synagogue as the best model. And, there's a lot of reliance on, as you said, on the book of Acts as a way to interpret Paul's letters versus Paul's letters themselves, which is, a pretty big mountain to climb for many scholars, getting over the Acts hump, as it were. But you counter these various objections against the use of associations, and you say that other models of community organization need to be seriously considered, which, you're pointing toward associations the entire way. In one of your more recent essays, you argue that association is kind of the big umbrella term, and, as you say, Christ groups, the churches, and the synagogue are underneath this big umbrella. So what are the most common assumptions or objections to your use of the data from associations that you encountered early in your career? Was it just people assuming that Christians are unique in the ancient world, or is there a little bit more to the objections that they had?
I would start with, I think there was the assumption that Christians were unique, and Christianity, there was a lot of language around the triumph of Christianity. So what I would call the grand theological narrative that has run through history, mm-hmm. and so the inevitability of why Christ groups would succeed. And in order for them to succeed, they must have been different than, but also better than, mm-hmm. All the other groups. Jonathan Z. Smith has a book published in 1990 called Drudgery Divine. Mm-hmm. And so at first I was playing a lot off that. And I think people that were reacting to our work were still falling into this thing he was trying to counter. And there, I think he rightly points out in previous scholarship, talking about Christ groups coming through the synagogues, use the synagogues as kind of a prophylactic to keep it from so-called paganism. That and it's sort of in part reacting to the history of religion school from earlier that kind of said Christianity got everything from Mithraism, so we can discount it, and then saying, oh no, they got it through the synagogues, and that's monotheism, so that's okay. Mm-hmm. And so the concern wasn't with synagogues per se, it was with Christianity and kind of protecting it. And so I don't think Meeks was particularly trying to do that, but it kind of fits into that. Mm-hmm. And so when I was reading him in light of all the inscriptions, I thought we have to test other models. And I probably pushed back a little too hard at that time against the synagogues and saying, oh, it's separate than the associations. And in later work, I've, you know, with people like Anders, I was just at a conference in Sweden with Anders Runnison, and we've had, you know, he's done so much great work on and synagogues as associations. And I think he's absolutely right. And, you know, I've done a little bit of that in the 2015, 2016 essays that aren't in this book, that the synagogues kind of fit into that model. And so there's no need to kind of make it quite that like the lines between them that were being made up front. So those articles are reading them now. So I was pushing back hard because that was what we were getting hit with. You know, hard no, absolutely not. It's the synagogues and look at Acts. That was one event. And the other is Christianity is different. And that's why I go through things in that article and the Translocal Links article. So picking up on the places where they say, well, Christianity uses a term you don't find very often in association groups, ecclesia. That's not wrong. You don't. But if you pulled out a Dionysus groups and look at that, you know, the word, one of the words they use, technetai. If you pull them out and say within the great swath of associations, you don't find technetai used for very many of them. Mm-hmm. So they're unique and different and special. Mm-hmm. And I was just trying to say, if you don't pull Christianity up, we pull one of the other ones out, you can make the same kind of their special argument. And so it's like everybody is the same and everybody's special.
And of course, ecclesia holds a special relevance for us that it may not have had for them quite at the time. And you do a good job of showing that the ways that people called their groups aren't very common among groups, even though sometimes they stick. And the Translocal Links article that you mentioned, I don't know if it's worth saying something a little bit more about that, but one way that the uniqueness of Christianity, it seemed like, was expressed in other scholars that you argue against is that, Christianity is different because there are ties between the ecclesiae of Paul that don't exist in the Greco-Roman associations. But you say that, no, that's not true at all. Actually, there are ties between ethnic groups from different cities, for example, that would help one another financially at certain times. And often the links between Christian groups are overstated at times. So you problematize that that whole thing there. Let's move on to the next question, though. The data that are related to associations as group organized and are in a kind of a generally localized setting, and that means that the biggest relevance of your work is to the individual ecclesia of Paul. Basically, that the data that we find from the Greco-Roman world can be applied most quickly to them. So, is it fair to say that the bulk of your attention has focused on the less theologically cited letters of Paul? So instead of Romans and Galatians, which seem to get all of the headlines in Pauline scholarship, you have tended to focus on Philippians, 1 Thessalonians, and 1 and 2 Corinthians. Has this limited the work, the uptake of your work at all? And I'll continue to another part of the question. I'm also interested in a comment that you made in the introduction that gets expanded upon in various essays on the different facets of the Thessalonian community. So you say something like Thessalonica functions closer to an occupational association, whereas Philippi acts more like a religious association. So there are kind of two different models that Paul's communities, I guess, it's not Paul himself necessarily, Paul's communities are forming and thinking of themselves in different ways. Do these come from an intrinsic facet of Paul's own approach to these communities or something else? And can you explain why they would behave differently when they're both called ecclesia?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that actually takes me right back to where I started. In my PhD dissertation, which I was working on in the early to mid 90s, the go-to for understanding the structure of Paul's communities was Corinthians. So we have a lot of data from Corinthians, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and sort of a lot, he talks a lot about the structure there. So, you know, yes, I admit I was not that interested in the theology. So, you know, Romans, Galatians, that sort of fell by the wayside a little bit. But I thought I was reading Corinthians, but I was doing a lot of work on Thessalonians and even more so on Philippi at the time. And I thought it doesn't, like a lot of stuff from 1 Corinthians has been imputed onto Thessalonians and Philippians. For example, you know, well, of course they had the Lord's Supper. We know that from Corinthians. I'm like, well, you know, where does it say that in the text? So my goal early on was to show how different the Macedonian, and I put them together, the Macedonian communities of Paul, Philippi and Thessaloniki, were different than the Corinthian ones. And then I was using the association data to kind of unpack what kinds of social practices, you know, I worked on the text from both those cities and the whole region of Macedonia. To my surprise, what I hadn't anticipated, but it makes so much sense now, but you know, it's naive at the time, is how different they would end up looking from each other. I assume because they're 110 kilometers from each other, Paul, you know, most likely went from one to the other pretty quickly, and they're all in Macedonia. So of course they'd be similar in structure and et cetera, et cetera. And the more I worked with the text, the more I realized they're not. and that kind of led to thinking, what I was resisting from using 1 Corinthians, I can't also then methodologically say, well, Philippi is like Thessalonica. Certainly they can help us understand each other when we, again, comparing them as if we were comparing them to a non-Christian group. So where are their similarities, where are their differences? But yeah, that was a big learning curve for me and changed the nature of the dissertation. So I ended up using those broad categories of occupational versus religious or cultic kind of focus of a group, in part because of the language in Thessalonians, just there's so much of it that resonates with what I would expect in an occupational association. And that's simply not true at Philippi. And, you know, with a mixed gender group and focused on some of the language around ritual sounds more like the kind of groups that we as scholars lump into a category we call religious associations.
Great. I should say at this point that my own introduction to your work came in the course of reading for comps, and one of my comps was on the Thessalonian correspondence. So I interacted with at least your essay that appeared in New Testament Studies on Paul's narration at the beginning of 1 Thessalonians of his own relationship with the Thessalonian group. So that spoke to me, and that encouraged me to look further into your scholarship. But some commentators on 1 Thessalonians, like Abraham Malherbe, have taken the data from Paul as evidence that the Thessalonians were that they kind of transformed into an evangelistic band after Paul and his group left a town under mysterious circumstances that people kind of, you know, look to Acts to explain. But you want to push back against that and say that well, the association data can explain what is going on here for the Thessalonian group. So getting into the nitty gritty a little bit on what's going on in one individual letter of Paul's, can you explain your argument short terms in that essay that appears as chapter 9 in this book? You say basically that they're just kind of doing a bit of self-promotion, honors for their patrons, honors for the God that they have now taken on, and they're not actually doing missionary work and going around and, you know, spreading the gospel, as it were. So how have you come to these conclusions, and what comparable evidence do we have from, you know, association data that similar self-promotion was typical of occupational associations as you have couched these Thessalonians?
That was a fun project as well to write, and again, it's part of a larger group with Ron Cameron, John T. Smith, John Kloppenburg, and others, called Redescribing Christian Origins. You know, Bill Arnell, Willie Braun, these all people that have continued to, and you know, were and are continuing to write on these things. And it was trying to think outside of the usual paradigms. And so for me, it was pretty clear from some other work I'd done that the whole so-called missionary journeys of Paul was a construct of Acts. And so then, you sort of and even weren't even imagined kind of as missionary journeys or weren't written about that way until the colonial expansion, you know, in the 16, 1700s is when you find scholarship at that time, theologians at that time, rereading Acts, rereading Paul through the lens of this colonial missionary. And I thought, okay, let's push back and see if that makes sense. If we take Acts out of the picture and look just at Thessalonians and at Paul's letters and what he thinks he's doing, within the broader context of what would we find imaginable at that time. That's where the comparative data is important. And I thought, given the time frame, is there, if I'm right, now there's a couple of ifs and ifs and ifs, but a lot of people seem to, not just me, but agree that the Thessalonian community was predominantly, if not exclusively, non-Jewish. At its core, he says in that first chapter, they turned from idols to God. And that's certainly not the way Paul, a Jew, would describe other Jews.
Right.
So given at their base, they probably know very little about the Hebrew Bible. And that, you know, what they've learned from Paul. And then to imagine they would go out and evangelize on this the way Mal Herbe talks about, you know, philosophical schools. And this, it just seemed to me that that would be stretching it a little bit. And what we found in the association data, of course, is the way the self-promotion of these groups would involve, you know, the Abaki inscriptions were the best one. You know, now we are the best of all Bacchic groups. Sort of the sort of like self-promotion in that way. And I, given that Thessalonica is a major port and would have a lot of traffic in and out, and that leatherworking, if that's what Paul was involved in there, is a transport, like it's a very easy to transport kind of occupation. People would move around following where the work is. I could imagine that's the way the proclamation is going, is more about, look at how great this group is. Mm-hmm. That would include linking to the deity. It's not that, but it's not what we would call mission. So earlier in the interview, you mentioned the sort of word ecclesia or church. And as soon as you use that word in a modern context, people have certain ideas. With my students, I use the word house. And I said, Jesus went into a house. And what, you know, close your eyes, what do you imagine when I read a story and I stop at house? And, you know, some of them name buildings that I know they've gotten from a Zeffirelli's Jesus film or, you know, one of them. And then usually three or four in, a substance says, well, I actually thought of my grandmother's house. And I'm like, of course you did. That's what you think of. And so when you hear the word church, you hear a certain thing. So when we think of mission, we think of it in a certain way that we've been enculturated to think of it. And I wanted to try and rethink it about recruitment rather than mission. And so, yeah, self-promotion, not missionaries, but just people going from place to place and being excited about something that had happened to them, but not making it the focus of what they're doing. They're not going out as missionaries. They're just traveling. But when you travel, you say, hey, you won't believe what happened. My group started following this new deity, and it's, you know, we talk about it, we fight about it, we argue about it. And these people died. We don't know what to do about it because we thought they'd be alive till this God came back. You know, those kinds of things are what we see being reflected in Paul's rhetoric in the letter elsewhere.
Right. And the data that you compare that to show that people would promote the deity that they have taken on in other associations. So the relevance is easy to see once you get into the nitty gritty of this work. So turning slightly away from the Thessalonians, after this discussion of their behavior, you then have sort of a pair of chapters under the heading of recruitment, which is something you mentioned just recently. You handle the ways that different associations would self-define, say basically this is what we are versus this is what we're not, and expand their ranks over time in ways that are available to us, sometimes through membership lists and sometimes through archaeological expansions that we can observe over time. These chapters are tied somewhat, again, to the question of the success of the Christian message, a topic that always, you know, attracts a certain attention. And whether we can deduce anything anything useful from this providential retelling of history that focuses only on the growth of Christianity in these early centuries. So what do you find relevant to this question from the evidence of recruitment, advancement, growth, and so on, from the self-promotional practices of Greco-Roman associations in this same period? And again, is Christianity unique in the way in this respect?
Yeah, well, I mean, the grand narrative says, of course, it is. I mean, Luke starts out with, 5,000 being converted, then 3,000 converted. But this is very practical, logistical questions that I think we started to ask because it was popping up in the association data. And that is, if your meeting place is X and it's limited to 30 people, what do you do if you are successful the way, for example, Acts imagines, and all of a sudden you have 500? You have a problem. Where are they going to meet? Mm-hmm. If you have a meal together, how are you going to feed them? So where are you going to put them? How are you going to feed them? And it made us and I wrote on it, but others did as well, start thinking about the restrictions on that kind of the logistical restrictions on that narrative of this quick and rapid expansion of early Christianity. Rodney Stark's work made us start thinking about a much slower incremental growth. And whatever may or may not be the problems with that paradigm, certainly I think the slow growth model makes a lot more sense. Certainly that would explain why Christians don't show up in the archaeological record very early on. But what we get with associations is groups that have grown over time to a place where they are showing up in the record. And yeah, their membership lists and even their bylaws might say, the group's limited to 60, and you can only get in if your dad's in. Or, we can see that, there's people have died and then they get replaced. And so it's a very limited, more exclusive group, which in some ways makes it more desirable. People want to be part of that. And so imagining, I should be careful. I think Paul imagined it was ever expansive, like he wanted everybody. I think, but the practicalities on the ground were much different than Paul imagined. So for the the problems at Corinth that he addresses were real logistical problems that he probably hadn't thought through when he was first there. And so they're addressing some of these things, around meals and with the Thessalonians around burial. And so, the data from the associations made us think about groups and go back and revisit the language of the letters and say what's going on there.
And you can see how, associations grew over time slowly and use that to think about how Christians might have grown. So getting away from Paul's letters, even in this case, you do have other chapters in this book relating data from associations to other early Christ groups, such as the community possibly behind Gospel of Matthew and whatever Luke is reflecting in Acts of the Apostles. So while I was reading your book, I was constantly reevaluating the evidence for associations through my work on the Shepherd of Hermas. And sometimes there are scholars who say that Hermas is part of an agricultural association of some sort, perhaps of salt farmers who, come to Christianity in a certain way. That's not to get too deep into Hermas, but just to say that I see the broad applicability of your work in ways. And of course, you have in the source book, lists of different inscriptions and so on from salt farmers. So that, popped in my head. Let's turn to some of the non-Pauline comparisons that you make. And we'll save the Acts stuff for readers of your book. So we'll turn to the Gospel of Matthew. Can you discuss the points of connections that you see in the Gospel of Matthew to association data and the sort of community development aspects in Matthew? How well developed basically is it as an association? I think you do some interesting work here complementing other scholars who have started this work, and you say, well, having been on the ground, knowing all that we do about the associations, here's what we see.
This is a fun one for me to write, in part because it was I just started my first job at Loyola University in Chicago and replaced a scholar, William Thompson, who had passed away. And they wanted to do a fesher for him on Matthew and asked me to write on Matthew. And I thought, I've never really worked on Matthew.
sounds daunting, jumping into a different pool than you're used to.
And you can see that reflected in just how many footnotes are on each page. It's like the more terrified I am, the more I need to sort of get into to make sure I'm okay. So with this one, it was really Bruce Molina's work got me into reading Tuchman on stages of community formation, forming, storming, norming, performing, journeying, kind of different stages. And looking at that point, at the association data we were looking at, I could see groups in different stages. You don't see any evidence for the, hey, we should form a group. All you sort of, they're already formed, but they do narrate how they were formed. So, God appeared to me in a dream and said I should do this, or friends got together to do X, or, these kinds of formative stages. And when we could see early on what they look like, and then bylaws tell us a little bit about the storming stage, where, again, the bylaws are the norms that tell us how they're going to live together, but they clearly come out of some problems in the community. I'll let readers unpack all, there's a lot of data there. But I realized Matthew narrates the Jesus story seems to assume the community have gone through that. And what popped out for me are the few places where we have that word ekklesia on the lips of Jesus, mm-hmm. right? So when he says to Peter, in light of his confession, on this rock, I will build my ecclesia. Mm-hmm. Or even more so when that's the foundation stage. But he's using a term that, we absolutely know Jesus wouldn't have thought like that. I mean, it's a theological commitment to imagine that he knew what was going on.
Right.
So put that aside and say, no, this is obviously reflecting a different stage. And then later on, chapter 18, where he talks, Jesus talks about what to do if somebody sins. And at one stage, you bring it to the church. But before, there's a whole list of things. Sounds like a group that's, again, it's reflecting kind of the bylaws, or at least, the ways other groups have negotiated that kind of disruptive behavior and how you address it. And then, as people well know, Matthew ends with the Great Commission: go out and recruit. And I realized that's not yet being done for Matthew. That's why he wants that at the words of Jesus at the end. That's the performing stage. And this is, go and do what you're constituted to do kind of message. So I kind of walked through Matthew and said, where do we see reflections of each of these stages? And the comparisons were with the association data in terms of where those groups were at the time.
Even if it may have felt like you were stepping into hot water talking about Matthew for the first time, it was an enlightening approach to it, thinking about how well formed the Matthean church is at the time that they reflect their traditions back onto the lips of Jesus. It's a very interesting approach to it, and I highly recommend that as well. Richard, this is your chance to correct a wrong that has been going on in scholarship for a while. Because among even an educated audience, you'll often hear Christianity described as a burial association or as a funerary association. This kind of being a model to think about how early Christ groups were, or maybe how they performed or something like that. But I gather from several of the essays in this book that this isn't a meaningful description of any association that you see from antiquity, even if their duties did sometimes overlap with, burying members who have died, who had no other means to afford a burial. So at one point, you even kind of dunk on a pretty prominent scholar for carrying this category forth when you don't think it's relevant anymore. So why has this concept of burial association no longer, why has this fallen away, and is it no longer supported among scholars like yourself who work on associations? And to return to the material of 1 Thessalonians for one last time, how does this recognition of burial and memorial as a typical function of these type of associations affect your interpretation of the episode that's happening there at 1 Thessalonians 4, where Paul reassures the community that the deceased will take part in the parousia of the Lord?
Yeah, this is that was a challenge early on. I think I would separate. So the The differentiation is the something they do, burial, versus their reason for being, mm-hmm. which is just simply to, or mostly to, as a burial association. And so very early on, as association inscriptions were coming to light, you have scholars at the time that are finding these things. We're talking 17, 1800s. A lot of the work there was looking to say, you know, how did Christianity survive, you know, persecutions and things like this? And this category of burial association is a way of saying, these associations seem to be very public about burying their members, which that's true. And this is a way they got around this ban on association, like on associations. They did this service of making sure bodies got buried. And this must be what helped Christianity survive. Now, it was tied in with the excavation of the catacombs, sure. and seeing all of the Christian iconography and art down there, you know, stories about this is where Christians hid in order to survive persecution. You know, they're in the catacombs. And so this whole, it was almost like we need an explanation for Christianity to have survived. And so burial association makes sense. And then the data was read through that way. So in 1982, Franz Ausbuettel kind of debunked this notion sort of on one level, Kloppenborg again, the 1980s, talking about a taxonomy. So although it seems like a lot of associations across time and geography did take care of burying their dead, that's never presented or almost never presented as the primary reason they existed. It's usually around their occupation or around some cultic consideration or some ethnic identification or a neighborhood identification, but not, we are constituted, I mean, even around drinking with the drinking buddies, they might take care of burying the dead, but it's not their primary reason. So we kind of took that as a categorization out because it was linked since, we didn't take it out. I took it out because the data's not there, but it helps dismantle Christianity again from this specialness that they do it in a way that protects them so they can eventually triumph. But then you're left with things like Thessalonians, where they're talking about dead people. And it looks like maybe they were a burial association, that they no longer do that. So what I've tried to show in my work is that that like other associations, burying the dead would have been one of the things that was given as part of the social network. You were sort of guaranteed a decent burial in the same way once a month you're guaranteed a pretty nice meal, or at least a simple meal, as being part of the association. And in the case of Thessalonians, they've been regularly doing this for their dead, because, you know, I think they were already constituted as a occupational association before Paul even got to them. And they've heard Paul talking about this new God who's going to come in and destroy the world, but you get a freebie to pass out of that. They, and I think probably not wrongly, have heard Paul to be saying this is going to happen quickly and nobody will die. And people have died. And they're like, oh, I guess we shouldn't bury them, but I guess since they've missed out, I guess they're not really included in our group anymore. And Paul's response is saying, no, they're just sleeping and they'll be caught up first, actually puts them back in the realm in the same way in associations. Even when someone died, you still went into their grave once a year. You might have honored them or had some memorial. You kept them alive as part of the group. You kept their memory alive. Again, that's not your primary purpose, but it's something you did, something that's you knew that when you died, that would happen for you. And I think I hear Paul saying that has to continue on until Jesus comes back. And then those of us, he includes himself in it, then we get caught up. And I think that's the giveaway. He's talked about it as happening in his lifetime. Mm-hmm. And they're like, but it didn't happen to these people, so they're out of it. And he's like, nope, just keep on the way you did before.
Absolutely. It sort of reminds me of the categorical error it would be if, for example, there was a 27th century archaeologist who, found evidence of Christian churches from, the 1800s, 1900s, and that you see that they all have cemeteries right next to them. And, oh, of course, it's a burial association, whereas we know that it runs much deeper than that today. So it's worthwhile to counter that whole thing. And I also appreciate the spin that you put on it with the First Thessalonians 4. Richard, to round out our conversation today, I'm doing something a little bit different and new. So thank you for being willing to be a guinea pig here. Are you active on YouTube? Do you watch YouTube videos much? Do you know what I'm talking about here when I say that there's kind of like tiered levels of analysis? I think it comes from a series of Wired videos where they ask experts in the field to explain a concept at, five different levels of difficulty for different audiences, first of which is like for a first grader. And I'm not going to ask you to explain associations to a first grader exactly, but at the New Books Network, we serve a variety of audiences all at once. And as a means of concluding this conversation, I wanted to know if you would be willing to filter your contributions to scholarship on associations and early Christianity for, laypersons in the church who might be interested in this type of stuff. They might have connections that they make to their own associations, whether occupational or otherwise. Then for pastors, then for students, which might be an advanced undergraduate or, a beginning seminary student, perhaps. And then also for fellow historians or scholars in the field. So you can feel free to accentuate different aspects of your work for each of these four audiences, if you will. But I wondered if you would be our guinea pig and explain your work, what you would hope that these different audiences take away from the kind of work that you do for laypersons, for pastors, for students, and for fellow scholars from your work.
Sure, that's quite the challenge. I think an important one in the sense of how do we communicate these things. So I could start with a layperson in the church. I think it's hard to even talk about the church as a lots of people that go to church, no matter kind of what brand it is, will think of at least hear about Christianity, hear the Bible being read, and think of the experience of early Christians being somehow different than theirs, that they did church all the time. That's all they thought about. But in their own lives, they go to church, but they might play adult hockey, their kids might play baseball, they might belong to a quilting group, these sorts of different other groups that are around their city. And I would say that's how we should imagine the early church as well. They weren't sitting around 7 days a week doing church. they had lives too. they're like you. And they were trying to figure out how to fit in their membership, which was very important to them and gave them a sense of belonging, a sense of identity, but at the same time wasn't their entire world. And I think sometimes people feel guilty about that. So, and then moving up to pastors, don't preach that old paradigm. help people understand how their faith fits into broader parts of their life. That's what the texts are trying to do. And there's this, Paul is imagining a world in which the Spirit just leads everybody, but people on the ground were trying to fit that in. So don't make Paul paradigmatic. Mm. It would be part of that. And then for students, I think here's where, again, seminary versus religious studies kinds of student might make a difference. But I think the work helps us have a different understanding of church today. So maybe that's also with the pastors and the way church is used to help navigate a sense of belonging even now, not otherworldly, but this worldly. And so for students, I would say continue to push on the context. And this kind of bleeds into the, what would I say to scholars as well. I do think we're past the stage, and in part the impetus for pulling these essays together in one book. We're past the stage right now where we have to make the case that the comparison is worth it. We really do need to do more and more of that kind of nitty-gritty work that you were talking about. So for students, I think figuring out where we are is important, and that we're at this place where we're past thinking about Christianity as somehow special or separated out. And then moving to scholars to say, help your students and in your own work, move into those, not revisiting the methodological, why should we do it, but the so what part of it. Like, how is it changing our understanding of Matthew, of Acts? Push back against me. Where am I wrong? You know, reading some of the, the translocal links essay. I think there's some things I would do differently now. Well, I should say, I think I do differently now. I think I pushed the data a little bit too much in part, but there's other data now that I use that I actually think that makes it a stronger argument than is in that essay. And that's why I included it in the book. I think it was important to kind of set the stage for the discourse. But there's more work to be done, and that's, I think, where the scholarship can take it.
And perhaps that'll appear in your second quarter century contribution, your second greatest album.
The volume, greatest hits, volume two.
Wonderful.
Usually on those albums, there's only one good song in that.
You're just playing off the old hits once again, right?
Exactly.
Very good. So, Richard, we have just condensed 25 years of your scholarship into about an hour, and inevitably there will be pieces of this that we didn't properly address or something like that. So if there's anything else that you'd like to make sure the listeners hear about, feel free to say it here. Otherwise, I would just ask you what you're working on next and what fresh scholarship we'll see appearing from you in the short term, and maybe have you back on the New Books Network to talk about.
Oh, that would be exciting. Yes. And new scholarship, I always say I'm going to get away from associations and do something different that I never seem to be able to. I've written a lot, even in this book, there's articles about death, and I continue to work on that. So, I think I have the makings of a book on death in the Greco-Roman world, not just in associations, but more broadly. But I'm excited about a new project I'm involved with in the development of Christianity in Thessaly in Greece. Silius Breitenbach is overseeing a larger project that basically is rewriting Adolf von Harnack's The Expansion of Christianity in two volumes into multiple very technical scholarly volumes. Mm-hmm. And so he's invited me to work with that group on that specific area. They've already done Macedonia and Achaia and the Lycus Valley and such. So these are big projects in the making. So I think it'll be a few years. And then, of course, inevitably, in our source book, I think in the introduction, we say it's a digestion of what will be three volumes, very technical volumes. Those three volumes are out and we're only halfway through the data. So okay. So there's three more to come. And I'm working on the inscriptions from the Western provinces. Not Italy and Rome. So one volume would be Italy and Rome, one will be the Greek islands, and one will be the Western provinces. So that's going to fill out that three volume. Will now be a six volume set of more technical explorations of a few of the inscriptions.
Well, excellent. Much work to do, and it sounds like you're well placed to perform the work very well. So, Richard, we thank you for your time today, for your work on this association data and its relevance to early Christianity, and thanks again for being our guest on the New Books Network.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Yeah, you're welcome. Again, Dr. Askoff's new book is Early Christ Groups and Greco-Roman Associations, Organizational Models and Social Practices, and it's available now from Cascade Books, wherever quality books are sold. I've been Rob Heaton, your host in New Testament and Early Christian Studies for New Books in Biblical Studies, and I'll be with you again on your next download, but in the meantime, never stop questioning. Thanks. Bye-bye.